Welcome to Modern Marketeers, the Barclay Health and Finance Podcast. Leading a health insurance company is not for the faint of heart. Health insurance is, without a doubt, one of the most interesting and challenging business categories today. It impacts every aspect of our society. In fact, healthcare itself makes up 25% of our gross domestic product as a nation. With this in mind, I invited today's guest to be on Modern Marketeers. Matt Aull is the CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas. And while he's only been in the role a couple of months, I think that's right, right?
About 6 weeks.
All right,
give
perfect.
Or take. That's right.
He has a vision for the company and healthcare that we'll discuss today. Matt, it's great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here.
Let's just dive into this healthcare aspect a little bit. A lot of people, I think, would shy away from being the CEO of a health insurance company today. What excites you about this role?
Well, I totally understand that. I don't know that people would feel that way if they spent a little bit of time working for a health insurance company or being mm-hmm. there quite a bit, because I think it's a lot more interesting and there's a lot more humanity to it that I think people fully appreciate. So for me, we meet people at very vulnerable moments in their lives when they're a loved one or sick or injured and they're confused, they're frightened, and they need us to help them. And so when we do our jobs well, and we try to, I'm just talking about the basics, by paying their claims accurately and on time, making sure that when they call us, we give them an answer that's helpful, even if it's not what they necessarily want to hear, we at least clear up those issues for them. And we allow them to, if we do those things, we allow them to focus on the things that matter most in their lives, which is getting themselves or that loved one nursed back to health mm-hmm. and dealing with family issues. And so it's also a time of great turbulence and change in the industry. So when I went to college, I majored in political science, and I also took a lot of economics. And so I wrote occasionally about public policy issues, and I found myself writing about healthcare. So this is roughly mm-hmm. 150 years ago when I was in college. So the issue is just as important and in many ways even bigger as a political and public policy issue today. And so I've always been really interested in the subject. Went to law school, came back, really didn't enjoy the private practice of law. I got really lucky to be hired by the person who was then insurance commissioner in Kansas, and then she ended up being elected governor. When someone gets reelected, that's when you get out. And so the general counsel job was open at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, and I just jumped at the opportunity because I knew how much I thought healthcare was an interesting topic, how important doing those jobs well was. So now that I'm at Blue Cross, and I've been there for 11 years. I mean, there's no place I'd rather be, and so I love it.
So you got to live through the ACA from the inside out.
I did.
The Affordable Care Act, obviously, yep. And we're in the business a few years before, March whatever 23rd of 2010 when that came into being.
That's amazing memory that you know that date.
I do remember that date very well because it changed almost everything in this category. It
certainly did, yeah.
What do you see as the biggest change from pre-ACA to now?
That's a great question.
And it wasn't on my list of questions. It was just as you went – you were talking about Kathleen Sebelius,
yeah.
I assume. You know.
So I think for consumers, if you qualify for a subsidy – and you don't have group coverage, what it does is take away a lot of the anxiety that you might have had before. Because what you can do is get insurance that's basically affordable. I mean, right there in the name of the statute. It's not affordable for everybody because,
right.
there are a lot of factors that go in there. But if you have a subsidy, then it's guaranteed issue now. It wasn't before. It's good coverage, real coverage. And these subsidies are generous enough and flex based on your income from year to year that it's something you can carry with you for a long time if you have to. And that, I think the individual market was a much more difficult place if you didn't have group coverage back before the ACA. I think for insurance companies, so we've had to deal with all that change, and so that's been a lot of work making that happen. And we've been in the ACA and in the individual market in Kansas every year that we've had under the ACA. So, but I think for companies, probably more than anything, it's been a shift in perspective that we are in a different moment in healthcare than we were before. You know, there's a lot of talk about healthcare reform for decades. I mean, from Harry Truman talked about universal coverage. I mean, and almost every decade we've had at least some big proposal, some idea to make healthcare universal. And I think once it finally happened, I think health insurers began to think about where is this going in the long run, which I think is a really productive thing. We need to have a system that works for everybody. It still doesn't work for everybody. And so I think just having with all the imperfections of the ACA, I think the process of getting ready for it, making it work as well as we can, has been a healthy one, because I think we are now imagining, you know, where is this going in the long run? Believe me, I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's a healthy thing for us to begin to think about.
There have been a number of changes over the decades. I remember, I think it was in Bill Clinton's second term, or right at the beginning of it, where we got health insurance to be portable.
True. Yeah, the HIPAA law. Yep.
Yeah, and people didn't realize, or today they're like, you mean if you left a job and you went to a new job, you didn't necessarily get health insurance?
Right.
No, that happened in 1996.
Yeah. The other thing, the big thing that happened in the 90s, other than the failure of the kind of the broader Clinton plan, was the passage of the CHIP program. And so right. There are millions and millions of kids that are covered today that weren't covered then. And that's really been the American model. It's probably still going to be the American model moving forward, is an incremental approach to what I hope will eventually be affordable universal coverage.
Yeah. And well, this is what makes this category so dynamic, you know, and I talk to my team quite a bit. I'm like, you'll never see another category go through this level of change and this much, you know, what's the right word, dynamic change.
Yeah.
You know, the whole issue of the regulation of healthcare, it's fascinating. It's just, I can't think of another category that's gone through this type of change.
No, it's incredible. And what makes it even more interesting is the size of it, because it's a huge, you know, right. You said 25%. That's actually a larger figure than what is normally said. But yeah, it's a huge part of our economy. And it meets people in really specific moments in their lives, and it takes on a level of importance that other industries don't very often. And so getting this right is really important. I mean, you think about what your life is like if you don't have insurance and you get hurt or you get sick. It can be a disaster for you. I mean, really, usually is a financial disaster.
Right.
That shouldn't happen in the United States of America in 2018.
Well, and I don't know that I have the stat right on that, but I know it's north of 60% of all bankruptcies are tied to health insurance or health care.
That's right. And there's been a lot of literature on that. There was a Time magazine article about it that kind of crystallized a lot of the literature that made it – that a lot of people read, and I think it made it clear what going to in the emergency room is like without insurance, and it's just a disaster. So the stakes are really high. It's really huge. It's also, I think, affecting our competitiveness as a nation. We need to be able to invest in lots of other things than health care. And so – we've got to get this right. And it ultimately comes down to getting costs under control. That is a really very difficult thing to do. If it were easy, we would have already done it. And frankly, even the other models that are out there, we sometimes tell ourselves stories about what, you know, the model in Sweden or the model in right. Britain or even the model in Canada look like. The fact is they are now dealing with some of the same cost problems that we are. And so as an American society and economy, but really all of us who are trying to get this right, we have a lot of work to do, because healthcare, it ought to probably at some level ought to be expensive in the sense that we ought to invest a lot of money in it, because it is really important. And when you or I are sick, then you know, we're going to want somebody that's highly trained, that has great access to technology and therapies. But it's got to be sustainable, and it's got to be affordable for everybody. And so that's just work that still remains to be done.
So with that point in mind, what's the biggest challenge that you face at Blue Cross of Kansas?
Oh, Blue Cross of Kansas. Well, I would say that the biggest problem that all of us face kind of broadly is just that, is getting cost under control. And what makes that particularly difficult is that the vast bulk of the cost in healthcare is concentrated in a relatively small part of the population. So the figures that are normally given out is that about 20% of our healthcare spend is nationally on 1% of the population, and about half is on 5%. And so the less expensive half of people take up less than 4% of our national healthcare expenditures. And the amount of money that we're spending on those folks is really great, and in many ways certainly should be. But because these are people who really need the care, these are people with multiple chronic conditions, these are people who have been in terrible accidents, these are children with hemophilia, these are people with cancer, who want to live, whose family want them to live, and they need care. Premature babies is another case of that are really expensive, but we all believe very much that we need the right people with the right training to do that. What the reason why I describe it that way is I think that the answer to making that less expensive is a lot more complicated than I think we sometimes realize. A lot of the talk about cutting down on costs is getting people to the right place for primary care, using a physician extender instead of an MD to do certain types of things, and those are all fine. We certainly believe in that sort of thing. We believe in working on making things more efficient in that way. But to really get at that they're going to need from us 10 and 20 years from now. And so, I mean, my first priority now is really just to invite people into that conversation. And I mean, the feedback I've gotten so far, I mean, it's only been 6 weeks, has been great. I think people really are anxious to turn their minds toward and their eyes toward those sets of issues and have a better conversation than we've had so far about it.
Do you think it's possible to bend the cost curve in a significant way?
I have to think it is. I mean, when something's unsustainable, by definition, it will end at some point. So
it'll collapse upon itself.
Yeah, I don't see a collapse. I mean, the negative sort of ugly scenario out there is more just kind of grinding into something that's mediocre, and I just don't think that's acceptable. So the answer is yes. I think it is, but it's a long-term project, and it's something where we don't want to do harm to the healthcare system along mm-hmm. the way. It's not something where you can just slam the brakes on 20-25% of our economy. We have to do it in a careful way. And there's a lot, as you well know, there's lots of work going on out there that I think shows some promise to make that happen.
So where does the innovation come from to do this?
The innovation. So let me just say that I tend not to use that word, the innovation.
okay.
Because I think it's widely misunderstood. So this is a bit of a quirk of mine. I think a lot of CEOs like to talk about innovation. What I think when I use the word innovation, I think oftentimes people think it's mostly creative work and I think it's mostly discipline. And I think it's mostly really careful thought. And I think it's mostly thinking about very carefully about what your business model is but being willing to be a little creative but also very experimental in a disciplined way to test things and figure out what works and then go back on that and iterate further. So where does it come from us? We just need to invite people in and put together if you're speaking specifically about our company, we've got to put the structure around that. And in our specific culture, what we need to do is invite people into that conversation and encourage them that we're going to try a lot of things. We're going to get some things wrong, and when we do, we're not going to be pointing fingers. We're going to pick each other up, move on to the next thing, and we're going to get a lot of things right, and we're going to celebrate when we do. What I think is that at our plan specifically, there are a lot of people who desperately want to get some traction and move forward on these bigger problems, and they want to do the right thing for members. And so I think the energy's out there. We just gotta tap it.
What role does the provider play? And how you – maybe it's not innovation. Maybe it's reinvention.
Yeah.
Or rethinking.
I don't know the answer to that. I think probably there are a bunch of different answers to it because there are some who I think have an enlightened self-interest and understand that their business model is not going to probably be able to be the same in 2030 that it was in 1970.
Right.
And that they're going to have to change the way that they interact with patients, that they're going to have to meet patients where they are more than they do right now. I think we in the health insurance industry, and I think, but I also think doctors and hospitals suffer with this as well. They think that it's patients' responsibility, and we sometimes think it's members' responsibility to meet us where we are. So call us during business hours. If you've got to sit 2 hours in the waiting room, that's the way it is. We're going to structure our products in a way that makes sense to us. If they don't make sense to you, I mean, that's your problem. You should have known that. I'm exaggerating a bit. But I think all of us are going to need – if we want to solve this problem for the broader population, I think it's incumbent on us to make this more understandable, less confusing than it has been. So I think that's one of the things that healthcare providers are going to have to do. More specifically, I think healthcare providers are going to have to get used to being paid differently and managing their population differently than they have in the past. We have, as you know, a system that is predominantly, both on the public programs and in private insurance – based on a fee-for-service system, which right. tends to encourage providers to give more care and more expensive care. And that is part of the problem. There's also a problem with the price point of those therapies that they, and treatments that they get. But what we're trying to do at our plan and a lot of other plans is experiment with ways to pay them for value instead of just for volume. And so that's something that a lot of them are interested in exploring. But it ultimately, both in health insurance and in with healthcare providers, the end state has to be something that is sustainable. Again, it's going to be something where their revenues are growing on a pace, on a par with the rest of the economy. And so that's there probably are 100 different ways that different changes that are going to have to be made to make that happen. But they're going to have to get used to that as their future. And so are we in health insurance.
Mm-hmm. So there are a number of entities around the world, particularly in the U.S., that are working to disintermediate health insurance or healthcare, probably
right.
not necessarily health insurance. But when you look at Aetna and CVS or Humana and Walmart or what's going on with Berkshire Hathaway and Amazon, what do you think they're trying to create?
It's a great question. I think I'll have to be careful because I don't know exactly. We can probably make some educated guesses. So on the CVS issue, I think they and Aetna are probably going to try to drive some of the basic primary care into a lower cost environment. So a clinic at CVS as opposed to a doctor visit. They're probably also and to some extent that may be more convenient. It may be a lower copay or something for insured. So that may create some consumer value there. I think what they're also two things. I think they're trying to create some additional volume at CVS. So if we can get people there,
right.
they're also going to buy some magazines and whatever lipstick. And they will also create some stickiness potentially between the Aetna and the CVS brand. So Aetna folks will tend to go to CVS and vice versa. The other thing I think they're trying to do is prepare for what they imagine is a gathering storm in healthcare, where you're going to have to be big and vertically integrated in order to be able to compete in 2025 in ways that maybe you didn't have to in 2005. I don't know whether they're right about that or not. I tend to believe that a local community by community approach may be the better approach than something big and national, but they're making a different bet, I think. Walmart and Humana have had I don't think that's really at the stage of a merger. It was sort of some of the initial press, but it looks like they're maybe just looking to expand their joint venture on Part D, perhaps do some of the other things I described in the CVS deal. The one that's harder to figure out, in some ways, is more intriguing, I don't know that any of us know what they're going to do, is the Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon.
JP Morgan,
yeah. So three very smart capitalists have done amazing things in their industries. Warren Buffett has been out there quite a bit criticizing the American healthcare market, and in many ways, rightly so. Initially, there was a lot of buzz about it. So they're going to use Amazon's analytics to transform healthcare. I don't know exactly how that's going to work. I don't know that the same analytics that tells you if you buy, this movie, you'll like that movie, or, this carpet, you're going to like that set of drapes. I don't know that's going to – what value that's actually going to drive in healthcare. And I don't even know what their ambition is. Are they looking to do something that's just going to help their employee population in their three companies? And that's
– perhaps.
That would be fine.
Right.
And then see if they can replicate that beyond that. Or are they truly going to try to get into healthcare? Or even health insurance. And I just don't know the answer to that, and I don't think they've been clear about it. And I don't even know if they know yet. So more broadly, when we talk about healthcare, back to kind of Walmart and CVS, the question that I have about those models, to the extent they are trying to drive people into those different venues for healthcare, I don't know. I think it's an open question about whether somebody wants to go to the doctor in the same place where they buy spark plugs and potato chips. I just don't know. I think in some ways people want to go to a different type of place that has a specific feel that where they go, it's more private. It is it's more kind of welcoming than
it's more about the experience.
More about the experience, yeah. Then I mean, I'm not trying to throw stones at CVS and Walmart. I have spent my time at CVS and Walmart. Grew up in a town with a Walmart in it, so I don't have any problem with those. I'm not sure that's where I'd want to go to the doctor, and so
right.
I don't know how universal or sort of broad that solution might be.
It's obvious from the conversation you think about this business quite a bit. Where do you draw leadership insight?
Man, lots of places. I have, you know, I think all of us in business do a lot of reading of the literature out there, the Harvard Business Reviews and the books that, that are out there, the TED Talks and things like that. But sometimes it comes from surprising places. So we have a message that we send out every Thursday to employees, kind of what we call a Thursday thought. And one of them recently was about Lorenzo Cain. So Lorenzo Cain was a really great athlete in high school, but he came to baseball late, and so he didn't have all of the skills that somebody like Eric Hosmer, who played all year round and was a baseball specialist, had. And his skills weren't quite as refined, wasn't quite as polished, but he was a super athlete, was really gutsy in the way that he played defense. And so people saw promise. He was drafted by the Brewers, came up through the Brewers organization, ended up being traded to the Royals in the Zach Greinke trade. And but what he realized is that he, even though his greatest strength was his speed, his foot speed, and his willingness to run in the outfield and on the base paths, he realized that the way he ran was causing him to be injured more often than was going to be sustainable for a major league career. So he went to a coach and learned how to run again. Changed his stride,
wow.
Changed the way that he planted, changed the way that he pushed off. And the message that I drew from that, and so what happened was he became better and better. He became really the cornerstone in many ways. You look at it statistically in the Royals and their two great years. He was the cornerstone of that. So the message that I got from that and we sent to employees was that sometimes you have to look even at the thing that you're best at. In order to get where you want to go down the road. And so Lorenzo Cain was an example of that. So I guess my message with that sort of longish story is that you find leadership lessons in unexpected places, and you just have to have your eyes open to it.
Well, that kind of leads to my next thought, which is if you were to think about three areas in which you wanted your company to excel next year, what would they be?
I don't know if I have three. I will say very specifically, we need to be better in the over 65 market in Kansas. We're a more rural. We tend to be an older population in our part of Kansas, and so we've just got to have better products than we currently do. We've talked about that quite a bit, and we're working actively on that. We have to have a more robust conversation internally about what the future is going to look like, about how we fit into that, about what we are and what we aren't, and what we might have to adapt to and change as time goes on. So I think that broader conversation, again, I tend not to use the word innovation, but probably that's overlaps with what you're talking about when you describe your process of innovation. We need to get better at that. I think we need to engage the market probably more than we have from kind of a sales and marketing perspective. I think we have a great brand. I think we've earned that. I think our marketing team has done an incredible job over the course of time, making sure that we remain relevant. But it's a broader effort. I think everything we do has led into that. And I think all the measurements that we've made of our brand show that. But I think probably we've taken it for granted that people are hearing us and hearing what value that we bring, and I think we probably need to think through how we're describing that more than we have. A fourth one, and this goes back to something I said before. We tend to, first of all, let me just say, these are all critiques of the company. I think we are a great company, and I think we do really important things for our members, and we do them really well, and we desperately want to. But I think the fourth thing I would mention is that we need to think about meeting consumers where they are in their lives. You know, we do that pretty well in some ways, but we tend to still believe that they need to come to us under our terms. And I think we probably need to think more broadly about how can we make ourselves available to consumers when they need us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be, you know, as you know, probably technologically driven to some extent. But there are probably some channels that we need to open up that are more accessible, easier for people to get the information they need than we currently do.
Well, and sometimes it's as important to know what to stop doing as it is to know what to do next. What do you think the industry should stop doing?
What do I think the industry should stop doing? I think health insurers and the health insurance industry need to stop imagining that the world is going to continue to go on like it has for, you know, for 75 years for us, and even longer for some insurance plans. The time is going to come when we're going to have universal, sustainable insurance. And I think sometimes we imagine that we can just keep moving our business model down the road, and it'll be okay. So I think in many ways what we need to do differently is just have a change in perspective. And I think, as I've said, I think that's happened to some extent, but I think we really need to understand and really be aiming, earnestly aiming for a solution to this problem that has been with us for so many decades.
How would you think your employees would describe the plan today to you?
I think they would describe it as a stable place. I think they would describe it as a family-oriented place. You can come to work at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas in Topeka. You can raise a family. You can have a job that's at very different levels, wherever you happen to be in your career, that's challenging, that I think is more rewarding than you might imagine if you're not in the health insurance industry. And but you can also go home and raise a family. And I think they would – I think we treat people well. I think it's a good place to work. I think that they would say that that we've been traditional in lots of good ways and probably in a few ways that are holding us back. And I think they probably imagine that it's time for us to turn our eyes toward the future and begin to think about how things can be different. I think there's a hunger in that right now. But it's a great place to work, and I think people would generally say really positive stuff. And that's something we can't take for granted. We've all worked places where the culture is toxic, where there's not trust, where you're afraid of your supervisor for some reason, or for whatever reason, it's just not a good place to work. I think there are very few people who come to work at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas and have that experience. But what I think we need to do is begin to think about, in a careful way, that preserves what's good about us, what things need to change, and what a sustainable, a better future will look like for our members.
That really was my next question, too, is how do you think your members would describe the plan today?
I think that there is, at least by the standard of health insurance companies, a great deal of trust between our members and us. And we actually have that in our mission statement. Now, mission statements can be kind of cliche, but I think that we I think we believe in it. I think we live it. So our mission statement is being the insurer that Kansans trust with their health. And so we spend a lot of time making sure that we do things the right way. You don't see us in the paper in negative ways. And so what I think they believe when they call us, they're going to get helpful information. They come to know that they can take our membership card about anywhere in the state and get health care. When the doctor gets that membership card, they're happy to see it because we pay our claims accurately and on time. We don't hassle people. And so I think that there is a lot of comfort when they think about us.
Any parting thoughts that we haven't covered today?
Well, I would just say that this is something that all of us need to be involved in as citizens, as business people. I know certainly in your business, I know that you're involved in it quite a bit because the stakes are so high. What I think the unfortunate thing about where we are right now is that we've been sort of sucked into the vortex of American politics. And American politics is a hard place to solve problems right now. And so what I would hope that we would do over the course of time is think carefully and clearly about what the nature of the problems are and how we can solve this as a whole society and not a divided society, you know, that has a red solution and a blue solution, because the stakes are way too high.
I agree.
And there's an American model for this that I think will unfold as time goes on. And it's important for us just to have a great conversation as a society, as an American society about it. So I hope people will stay engaged. Keep your heads about you. Think about what the problems really are. And hopefully within our lifetimes, we'll have a solution to this that makes sense for everybody.
That's great. Matt, thank you.
My pleasure.
For coming on the show today.
Happy
I appreciate
to do it.
My guest today has been Matt Aull, CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas. Join us again next time for Modern Marketeers, the Barclay Health and Finance Podcast.